Last week ended with a question. What did love mean in the environment where you first learned about love? Most people, when they sit with this question, don't immediately have an answer. What they have is a feeling, maybe a familiar shape, something that arrives not as memory, but as recognition. A patient I'll call Elena came to me in her mid-30s. She was really accomplished. She was professionally successful, someone her colleagues relied on and her friends described as very generous and giving. And she was exhausted in a way that she couldn't quite name. In one session, she's described it this way. I don't think I've ever let anyone love me without first making sure I deserved it. And I asked her what she meant. She said, I have to work for it. I mean, I make myself useful and I anticipate what people need before they even know. And then, only then, did she feel safe enough to receive anything back. Like, there's a toll she had to pay before love was allowed to land. That's heavy stuff. And I want to use this example to talk about a lens for the first relational learning around love. The ordinary affection, the care, the attention, the belonging through which we begin learning what closeness feels like. Before you ever decide what romantic love should look like, you've already spent years learning something about closeness. And the toll that Elena was feeling is where this learning lands. Today on Ask Dr. Gill, I want to talk about how love is embedded in our nervous system. So stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Ask Dr. Gill. I am your host, Dr. Gill Winkleman, and today on the podcast, we're going to talk more about this idea of love, but I want to talk about the nervous system as it relates to love, because I think there's an aspect here that often gets overlooked. And we talk about this in terms of attachment styles, by the way, because the attachment styles give us a description in many cases in terms of how the nervous system is responding to the situation, right? But I want to go a little deeper, right? So obviously the nervous system doesn't sit there and form a theory of love. I want to describe this precisely. Your early relational experience taught your system what to expect when you reach towards another person or another person reach towards you. And it's not about the nervous system coming up with a definition of love. It's not about that. It's about patterns of expectation related to closeness and interaction. And by the way, this like unconsciously creates either closeness or distance in all of our interactions in life, right? Depending on what happened in your early childhood and how your system is wired. And not that you can't rewire it, by the way. But so here's the kind of the idea. What happens when I reach in a particular way? Does someone come closer or do they pull away? Or vice versa. When someone comes towards me, do I move closer or do I pull away? The system has been learning this through repeated interactions before you even had language, before the child had an explicit framework for what's happening. Those repeated experiences become part of the model that goes forward. And I'm called, I'm calling the felt contract inside the app model an implicit bargain. It's kind of my clinical framing for this rather than established terminology. It's useful in terms of naming it. It's the unspoken rule the nervous system carries forward about what love requires, right? And something hasn't been taught this explicitly. Elena's bargain, when she eventually articulated it, was something like this. Love is available to me if I'm useful. When I'm giving more than receiving, when I've made myself indispensable enough that removing me would cost something. She hadn't been taught this explicitly, right? It wasn't, I mean, in some families, this does happen. Well, I'll give you this if you do this, right? But that wasn't the case with Elena. What she learned was through patterning, through interactions in which warmth may have arrived when she achieved, or she helped, or she anticipated, and it receded when she was simply present or uncertain, or if she needed something. The system drew its conclusion from those experiences, right? Early experience is one place these bargains form. Later relationships, loss, betrayals, other significant experiences can write into them too. That reading was adaptive in the environment where it was formed. And I've seen this with patients, by the way, where they had a good relationship with other, and until there was like a really bad relationship that sort of broke them, if you will. Their words, not mine. And I think that does happen as well. Now, but adaptive in one context isn't always universally true. And the prediction often doesn't update simply because the environment changed. It updates through experience. Later relationships become places where the old bargain can reappear. Not because the past determines the present necessarily, but because the nervous system is still running a prediction it formed long ago. Elena had been in a relationship for 3 years with someone she described as genuinely loving, someone who showed up consistently, who didn't require her to perform, who seemed to want her presence more than her productivity. One evening he said, "I've got dinner tonight. Sit down." She got up to clear the kitchen, and he said, "I said I've got it." She kept moving anyway, and she realized afterwards that she hadn't been helping him. She'd been regulating herself. She wasn't doing the dishes because the dishes needed doing them. She was doing them because sitting there while someone cared for her felt strangely unsafe. That same behavior can serve two purposes. She may have been genuinely helping, but that helping was how she was helping herself regulate. And her problem wasn't just that she gave too much. Her problem was that receiving without giving felt unsafe. In session, she described it this way: "I keep finding things to do for him, things he didn't ask for. And I realized afterward that I did them not because he needed them, but because I needed to feel like I was paying my toll." That sentence is where this bargain became visible for her. And while what she was experiencing wasn't pathology, it was a coherent prediction running in a new environment. The prediction, love requires a toll. The present evidence, the person loves me without one. The system response, that can't be right, but keep paying anyway. Now, I want to point something out here real quick as a quick aside. You know, when you're genuinely doing for something out of your heart, like Elena's partner did, he wanted to just give to her and he had no expectation in return. That's a devotional expectation, right? But what Elena has been experiencing was something different. It wasn't that she was doing it because she wanted to do something out of the goodness of her heart. She was doing it because she felt a compulsion to do it, right? She was responding to two things at once, the person in front of her and the bargain she had learned to bring into love. And the gap between what the earlier environment taught and what the present was actually offering was producing anxiety in her, not relief. The deeper pattern wasn't really about payment. It was about conditional access to connection. A system that learned connection required a toll doesn't know what to do when that connection arrives freely. It reads it not as safety, but as something that's unaccounted. Have you ever received something genuinely good, care, attention, generosity, and felt the pull to return it before you finished receiving it? Not from a reciprocity, but from the quiet sense that accepting it would bring an imbalance into your life. That's the toll. And as a quick example, I probably have used this on the program before, where someone pays you a compliment and you immediately either deflect it or pay them a compliment back, right? Without letting the compliment land. I'm going to take a quick break. And on the other end of the show, we're going to talk about different bargains and how this relates to you. So stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to Ask Dr. Gill. I am your host, Dr. Gill Winkleman. And today we're talking about love and what we learned that love costs us. I want to get back to Elena because her bargain was organized around usefulness, but implicit bargains can take different forms. These aren't three types of people, I would say, and there's probably more than this, but there are three ways that I have seen this show up in terms of this organization. And sometimes it sounds like a performance. I am loved when I achieve. Ordinary present isn't enough. Results are what makes me worth being here. Sometimes it sounds like disappearance. I'm safer when I need less, when I take up less space, when I make myself easy to be around by not having too much of my own. And sometimes it sounds like vigilance. I stay connected by anticipating what other people need, and the moment I stop watching, something shifts. And none of these are character flaws. I just want to be clear about that. And sometimes these are done in ways that are genuinely about love and devotion to a person. But oftentimes, these are workable responses to the environment. And generally, it's the environment you grew up in. The child who learned to perform may have noticed that achievement brought more attention or connection. The child who learned to disappear may have found that taking up less space made things easier for them. And the system drew conclusions from what it actually encountered. Here's the thing about these strategies. They're protective, but protection isn't necessarily the whole story. The reason connection mattered enough to protect it is that we all need connection, right? The strategy wasn't random. It was an attempt to preserve access to the people who mattered most, or to stop being hurt by the people that mattered most. Protection was not the whole purpose of the strategy, but it was often that it was there to preserve the connection, to preserve access to the people that mattered the most. And in terms of like avoidance, you know, obviously we might avoid getting hurt when we were little if we have abusive parents, and staying hidden is how we do that. But we still needed our parents for survival. There is still a need to stay connected to them. And that's the conundrum that for many people, they're bringing something like that into their adult relationships. Now, once you see the bargain, there might be another question you might want to ask, which is, if love required payment, what was the payment needed in my case? Now, for many people, this may be a disturbing realization that healthier love doesn't necessarily feel like love. And this is really interesting that I've seen in terms of this. And we're going to address this in future episodes, by the way. When someone offers you something different from what your programming has predicted, and love arrives and there's no toll, right? You can just feel it. Does it feel like love? And the answer for most of my clients has been, it doesn't immediately feel like love. It's very foreign to them. Sometimes the problem isn't that healthier love feels bad, by the way. It just doesn't feel like love. There's no that je ne sais quoi, you know, that thing that we have when we fall in love. Like oftentimes in these situations, it's not there. And this is, by the way, my theory as to why when you hear the stories of, oh, I knew this person for years and then one day we fell in love. It's because that certain thing that you have in other relationships because it's familiar from your familial upbringing isn't there, right? And familiarity often feels like truth to us. And you know, in terms of love, it's really about the nervous system having learned a particular shape of what love requires, but love is so much bigger than that, right? And so sometimes when leaving the familiarity, it feels incompatible. But unfamiliarity isn't necessarily unhealthy. It's, you know, and same wise, just because it's unfamiliar doesn't mean that it is healthy. Strange doesn't automatically mean better. Familiar doesn't automatically mean wrong. The point is that familiarity alone isn't enough information. Familiarity is information. Neither should make the decision by itself. Sometimes unfamiliarity is unhealthy, and sometimes unfamiliarity is very healthy. So I want to be clear about that. Your nervous system, though, it gravitates towards the familiar, and that's the important thing to recognize. And if you grew up in an unhealthy situation, be aware of that if you're dating, right? Be aware of that as you're parenting, because these are the things that help you recognize how to sort of reorganize these patterns. Now, you can be offered something that you really wanted, and some part of you doesn't know what to do with it. Not because the offer is wrong, but it doesn't match the bargain that you've been expecting. The bargain wasn't a mistake. it was understandable reading of what love required in the environment when it was formed. And it probably made sense to us. But that environment may not be around anymore. And we recreate that in our minds. That's the thing that's so amazing to me. The question isn't whether the reading was accurate then. The question is does it still fit now? And I think that oftentimes the prediction doesn't update when we're in new environments. In fact, I think we just recreate it over and over again until we become conscious enough of it so that we can start to update the programming through repeated experience, through healthier relationships that provide a different set of evidence. Elena described what happened when she stopped performing compulsively, when she let herself be present and didn't feel like she had to pay the toll. She started to see that it felt like she was wearing something that she didn't even know was on. And several months later, her partner made dinner for her, and he said, "I got this." And she still felt the pull to get up, and the anxiety came up, and she stayed seated, and she let him take it and do it. And she, you know, it was interesting because she said to me, "You know, I never thought about it this way, but he wanted to do the thing for me. And my not letting, like my getting up was sort of interfering with his ability to give to me, right? So if you can't receive, that means the other person can't give." Interesting. So your nervous system didn't learn what love is as much as your nervous system learns what love does. And I have two questions for you. What did you learn love would cost you? Not what were you told, but what did you learn? And is it still true? Next week, we'll talk about why we're attracted to who we're attracted to and what happens when the nervous system mistakes familiarity for compatibility. And if you haven't taken the quiz yet, I'd encourage you to do it. The link is in the show notes. And you can also check out my websites and see the offerings that are up there. And thank you so much for joining me, and I will see you next time.